Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of society, to those who know that the world's political, religious, media, and military, the world's economic institutions cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is not to try to finagle a way that we can get more red chairs or blue chairs into Congress. It isn't to figure out how we can take back a religious institution and take it back to its roots. It isn't to figure out how we should act in the great debate between adoption and abortion, between homosexual marriage and heterosexual acts of indecency. That's not where we are going to spend our time, because it doesn't make any difference. Nothing's going to change. It's time instead that we focus our attention as to why these things are happening. Who's misleading us? Why are they doing so? Why are virtually every human institution, why are they counterproductive? And then once we recognize who is doing what to whom, to encourage people to disjoin, to walk away from them, to stop being political, to stop being patriotic, to stop being religious, to stop affiliating with those who are so demonstrably hostile to what is in our interest. So we're going to look behind the headlines. We're going to hold people accountable. We're going to consider these things, because exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes isn't hateful. The most caring thing we can do. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, because its teaching provides the only answer for you and your family. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion anytime over the next 3 hours, toll-free, 877-300-7645. The question is, are you willing to go where the evidence leads? Even if a rational evaluation of the evidence leads to a repudiation of your political, patriotic, and religious beliefs. The Secretary of Defense of the United States was heard in the news saying that he is shrinking the size of the U.S. Army. Now, it's not materially. The U.S. Army is well over 500,000, and he is shrinking it to just under 500,000. He did not tell you, however, that he is at the same time wants to take that money and to spend it on making the U.S. Navy more lethal. He wants to eliminate a large contract for boats, that ships, if you will, that are coastal in nature, that aren't nearly as lethal, and to be able to project the force further out to sea with the ships that are vastly more deadly. And that's how he wishes to spend the money that he saves on reducing manpower. And he said that the world was more unpredictable. That's not the least true. Not even remotely true. The world right now is extraordinarily predictable. I would have to say that the world has never been more predictable. Not only does God tell us what's going to happen over the next 20 years, and where these various wars are going to break out and what the consequence is going to be, who's going to prevail and who's going to lose. But in addition to that, the players are so well known. This administration wishes to change the enemy. For years it has devoted its resources to fighting a war against a tactic. That tactic, of course, is promoted 99.9% by fundamentalist Muslims, but they don't want you to know that. And because they know that, and the fact that they are supportive of Islam, they have moved to a position where they no longer want to wage that war. No, because that war is way too hostile to their interests, because they don't want to fight Islam. So they've decided to direct America's military at America's principal benefactor, the Chinese. Yes, the Chinese, more than any other nation, hold America's debt. Should the Chinese decide tomorrow that they want to disgorge themselves of Americans' debt, America's bankrupt. We would be in far worse shape than what we're witnessing in the Ukraine. So this is a rather important issue. He is lying in saying that the world is less predictable. He is lying when he said there are forces out there that are more hostile than ever before. That is not true either. And it's certainly not true of the Chinese. It would be very much like a family deciding that what they want to do is they want to buy the local grocery store, and they want to buy a local farm that supplies that local grocery store. And right after they buy it, they want to salt the ground of the farm, and they wish to torch the store. Now, that's the situation with China. Oh, you could add to it. So at the same time, they would like to loot and occupy all of the homes that were customers of that farm and store. Yeah, there's 0% possibility that the Chinese, whose principal customer is America, are going to go to war with America. Zero. I mean, beyond the fact that they'd have no incentive to do so, beyond the fact that they are the holder of America's debt and it would make America's debt worthless to over $1 trillion, but beyond that, the Chinese have no capability of projecting a force and aren't going to have any capability of projecting a force. They have one uncompleted aircraft carrier. That won't do it. Not even remotely. So this is just utter nonsense. The most hostile nation in the world is the United States. It's not those others that are surrounding us. We need to look in the mirror. I've said that on this program many times that it is long past time that we consider doing what Jefferson begged us to do, to eliminate our military, not just to cut it back from some $700 billion squandered each year, not just eliminating the $50 trillion that has been spent, squandered by the Department of Defense over the past 50 or 60 years. Just to eliminate it, we would be vastly more free. We'd be vastly more secure if we were to do those things. There is a terrible myth that has been permeated by Washington, D.C., one that is resonated again just recently, as recently as yesterday. That is the myth of he's killing his own people, so we need to stop him. We said that of the communist dictator in Korea. We sacrificed 35,000 American lives. We said that of Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam. We sacrificed 55,000 American lives. We said it of Mullah Omar and Osama bin Laden, as there were videos of them occasionally stoning a woman to death, saying they're killing their own people. We need to stop them. And so we invaded Afghanistan and lost 7,000 additional American lives. We said it of Saddam Hussein. He's gassing his own people. Look what he did to the Kurds. We need to stop him. It was a grotesque exaggeration, out of context. We didn't want to reveal the fact that America supplied the chemical weapons that he used. We don't want to admit that he was in the midst of fighting a war against the most lethal foe in the world today, Iran. We don't want Americans to know that the Kurds, whose village they gassed, had just been armed by the Iranians and were waging a very successful military campaign against Iraq. And that twice Saddam Hussein had tried to use conventional means to suppress the Kurds who were fighting in conjunction with the Iranians, but they were too zealous, too deadly, too effective. and had he not gassed that village, the Iranians would have prevailed in conjunction with the Kurds and have won that war. That's how close it was. But we preferred the lie. Yes, these were just little babies and mothers, innocent people who had no contribution to their own demise, so that we could invade Iraq. And look what's happened. We gave Iraq to Iran. Not only did nearly 7,000 Americans die in that process, but having returned from what is a suicidal war, a counterproductive war, a war where America lied to everyone, where the basis of invading was a lie, and where the battles were all depicted as lies, where the very people America said we went in to free were those who were killing us, that there was no distinction between civilians and jihadists. Some 80 Americans who have come back have taken their lives every day. That totals well over 200,000 and approaches 300,000 who have lost their lives based upon that lie. And then there was Assad, Secretary of State Kerry, constantly screaming, he's killing his own people. Out of context, of course, why is he killing his own people? Because we armed them. Because we created a disaster in the Middle East, giving Iraq to Iran, providing weapons to the Sunnis, providing more weapons to the Shiites. It spilled out from Iraq into Syria, and then we began supplying countless amounts of weapons to Qatar and to Saudi Arabia to arm Sunni jihadists so that they would go after and try to kill Assad and his regime. He's not killing innocents. Oh, sure, there is lots of collateral damage in this war because there is no difference between an Islamic jihadist and a civilian. All Islamic jihadists are civilians. But he's not killing innocent civilians on purpose. He's responding to an international proxy war that has been waged against his regime. Yes, he's an evil man. But this simplistic notion that he's killing his own people, we need to intervene, is the same thing we said in Korea, Vietnam, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. It's becoming a broken record, and we're saying it again. Not only did Obama want to bomb Damascus because Assad was killing his own people, he doesn't want to put it into context and say, well, you know, we've supplied the weapons and a substantial number of the people that are doing the killing there, streamed in from Iraq, where we again supplied the weapons, and that they are coming from countries around the world to wage a proxy war against his government. Don't want to ever put that into context because, of course, if you knew the truth and the whole truth, you would never side with the American government and its desire to deploy its military. We've done the same thing, of course, with Yanukovych, the socialist former communist that was the head in the Ukraine. Oh, he's murdering his own people, Susan Rice said before Meet the Nation over the weekend. Well, that's true, but it's not true in context. It's grotesquely misleading in context. Nearly as many police were killed. More police were kidnapped than protesters were imprisoned. Far more police were injured. Many burned alive, many shot by these allegedly unarmed and defenseless peaceful protesters. It is a situation where you've got a violent protest taking place in your country because the people want ever more concessions from their government, and the government can't provide them, so they go to war against their government. You have anarchy. And what is the proper approach? Do you let the anarchists take over? Or do you try to stop them? Is there a sane approach. There certainly isn't one when you have idiotic statements like those that are consistently made by the United States. And you have to be careful in these kinds of situations. You know, with the former communist leader, then Russia was burdened with the responsibility of their debt because the International Monetary Fund had tried four times, always in the $3, $5, $10, $15 billion range, providing loans to the Ukraine because the people are either don't want to work or incapable of working. And each time the Ukrainians welched on their agreements. And so now that the U.S. has put its full weight behind the violent protesters, the anarchists in this particular case, Russia said, thank you very much. Then you ought to turn to the IMF for your loan. Yeah, we were going to provide you with $15 billion, but not now. You need to look to the IMF again. And what's the number? $20 billion? But how long will the $20 billion last? A year, maybe two? And then what, another $20 billion? And do we continue to reinforce the fact that a government who borrows money based upon an agreed set of conditions doesn't have to pay it back, can welch on those conditions, and the IMF doesn't care, they'll supply more money? Where do you think the IMF money comes from? The American taxpayer? It's interesting to note, by the way, that the carnage that we witnessed in the Ukraine was really very little different than what we're witnessing both in Bangkok and also in Caracas, Venezuela. In Caracas, Venezuela, you've now have 13 that have died. Now you say 13 compared to 75. I mean, that's nowhere close. But keep in mind, on the 75, 67 police were kidnapped and held captive, some killed in their captivity. At least 10 policemen were killed on one day as part of that 75, with 30 more suffering gunshot wounds. One day alone, hundreds were severely burned. Many died as a result of their burns. The number of actual civilian casualties, maybe about 30 to 35. 13 civilian casualties already in Venezuela. We look at Thailand, the number is up into the mid-20s already in civilian casualties. About the same. What are we going to do? We're going to go bail Venezuela out because it's coming out of a bankrupt communist system, trying to? Are we going to bail Thailand out? The issue in Thailand is that the government has subsidies that it can no longer provide without going bankrupt. But the people are protesting, oh, we like our subsidies. You can't take our subsidies away. That's what happened to Ukraine. The Ukrainians wanted their government handouts. They wanted their subsidies. They wanted their pensions. They wanted their Social Security. They wanted gas at a fraction of its real cost. And because the Ukrainian government couldn't negotiate more money from the IMF without changing those things, depriving of those things, they're now rioting. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're returning to the carnage in the Ukraine, comparing it to what we have witnessed elsewhere. And it's interesting that in all three uprisings that are currently being witnessed by the world, whether it's in Thailand, in Venezuela, or the Ukraine, even in Bosnia, to add a fourth, it's all economic. And the issues are always the same. The same that we witnessed in Greece a year and 2 years ago, where by the people began to feel entitled. They thought that they deserved the salaries that they were being paid, even though they were not working very much for them. They thought that they had earned their pensions. They thought that they deserved their medical support. And it became such that the government was subsidizing everything. And it's essentially bankrupt to those countries. And then the people, when the country says, we can't borrow money anymore and to give these kinds of subsidies, these kinds of entitlements, the people protested, said it's not fair. But what are the options? You know, in the Ukraine, now that that the Ukrainians have, at least in Kiev, have protested against the Soviet-backed or the Russian-backed government, what now? Is Europe and the United States going to bail them out? Do you want to go to the American taxpayer as Senator John McCown from Arizona wants to do, and not just provide them loans, but provide them aid? How long is it going to take them to go through it and then need more? What's the end game here? Are we going to have an entirely new welfare class of foreign nations? Are we going to do what we're doing with Iraq and Afghanistan and continue to provide money that they squander? What is the end game? I mean, Mr. Haig, who is the foreign secretary for the UK, says that we need to discuss emergency financial assistance to Kiev because it's about to collapse. He says they need support from the entire international community. Well, that's why they're protesting in the first place. We have Glenn on the line. Glenn, welcome to the program. Hello, Glenn.
Hi, the Ukraine thing is just crazy. Russia, okay, I'll just cut to the chase. Russia
yes. right.
has leased naval bases in the port of Tartus in the Mediterranean, Syria. It has mm-hmm. leased naval base in Sevastopol in the Crimean Peninsula in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
The Crimean Peninsula was signed over by Nikita Khrushchev in 1954 to the Ukraine as a gesture of magnanimity, him never realizing that the Soviet Union could be broken up and that the Crimean Peninsula would end up no longer being Russian territory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They have huge interests here. Mm-hmm. Both of these countries, Syria and Ukraine, have these revolutions or these troubles being, fanned up by foreign-funded mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
And when push comes to shove, the Russians are not going to sit idly by where the access to blue water ports is threatened and their naval bases are threatened. And the Crimea, which is mostly Russian-speaking, and much of the Ukraine is right. Russian-speaking, is just taken away from them. Okay, they are
right.
going to act to protect their interests. And the people of the Crimea would welcome them if they rolled in there.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that rather than the Secretary of Defense saying that the world is unpredictable, what you're saying is that the world is imminently predictable, that Russia has vital interests in the Ukraine, and that Russia is not going to allow its vital interest to slip away. It would be very much like Abraham Lincoln saying that America has a vital interest in the South and is not going to let the South slip away. Is it
right.
Very similar?
Yes. Yeah, well, right. Well, I've seen recent videos of Putin saying that he had no intentions of invading Ukraine, but that's somewhat different than him actually, being asked to come in and intervene by the people of the Crimea who are not in favor of affiliation with the EU.
Correct.
And, well, the Crimea is where most of the wealth and industry of Ukraine is. So if he goes in, if Ukraine is fractured and balkanized and the Crimeans have the Russians come in and they take over, it's already a semi-autonomous region. If they invite the Russians in, then all the EU is going to get is the remaining, deindustrialized husk of the Ukraine, maybe some arable, agricultural land and stuff like that.
Yeah, let me say what I think is going to happen here. And I don't have Yahweh's prophecy here, so I'm just going to dance between the raindrops here a bit, connect a few of these raindrops. I think that Putin is relieved in one way. $16 billion is a lot of money, $15 to $16 billion. That's how much he pledged to try to keep the Ukrainian economy from totally collapsing. Now that they have an entirely different government, whether it is government by mutiny or however you want to look at it, it's very much like what's happened in other countries where the popularly elected individual was ousted and then called a killer and they wanted for trial. So it kind of reminds me of what's happened elsewhere. I think Putin's initial response is, oh, man, thank God I didn't give him $16 billion. Let's let the IMF support him for a while and just see how all that works out. And all the while, I know that the most vocal and reliable Ukrainians are actually Russians. They're Russian of Russian descent, and they speak Russian, and they are unified with me in the Russian Orthodox Church. I can depend on them. They're not going to tolerate this. The Ukraine is going to be severed. And and I think he's looking at it and says, all right, so let the Ukraine split up, and let the West be bludgeoned economically by supporting this monster, and I'll pick my time for coming in militarily, which, by the way, the United States could not stop. Europe and the United States combined couldn't stop.
Right. Well, the new government is already calling for Russian to be put away as one of the national languages, and for the national language to be strictly Ukrainian.
Right.
And all right, so right there they're fomenting, they're begging for a cultural upheaval just right there.
Of course.
And there is
no way that this country can survive that without being split. And then you've got this other issue. This is the 800-pound gorilla that is in the room that no one wants to talk about. And that is the reason that the Ukraine is bankrupt is because it subsidized Russian oil to the people. Their only supply of gas and oil is from Russia. Russia subsidized it to them, and they further subsidized it to their people. Now what's going to happen if Russia says, all right, I'll supply oil and gas to the Russians, those who don't want to split away, but you Ukrainians that are so angry at us, why should I do you the favor? Where are they going to get their gas?
There's already talk of them redeploying troops along the Russian-Ukrainian border and then rotating the troops there at Sochi over to over to Sevastopol. So all he has to do is cut off the oil and gas flow to Kiev, and then bring the oil into Sevastopol. Have the people, pop by popular demand, have them come up and protect the Crimea,
correct.
And then the rest, and then Kiev starves.
Correct. And why will that have happened? Because the people were grotesque. The people were immoral. The people were covetous, and they're going to get what they deserved. I mean, there are no victims in this case. They're going to get what they deserve. And in the meantime, what we have is more of the posturing for what's going to be the second phase of World War III. After the Magog War, the United States and Europe and Russia and China are going to engage. And what we're seeing is more posturing for that. We're making the world vastly more dangerous. And a lot of this, Glenn, is because there are very few people who are willing to analyze what has actually occurred and how different the world's rhetoric is from the events on the ground.
Well, all you need is a handful of 10th graders and a risk board of some dice and, get this all, it doesn't take a geopolitical analyst to figure this one out.
No. It's pretty clear and in this particular case, there is no good outcome. All of the outcomes for the Ukraine are disastrous, as they are disastrous for all the parties that engage. Whether Europe and the United States provide the heroin for that country, or Russia doesn't matter. Whoever supports what's left there is going to get badly bruised. And if there's a fight for the Ukraine, then everyone's going to lose.
It's almost like at this particular time, it's almost like it seems to me that all Putin has to do is bring his landing craft up, open them up, run the tanks and armored personnel and carriers in from Sevastopol right up to the border of the peninsula with the rest of the mainland, and just cut it off and say, okay, we're here, we're done.
Yes.
Have fun, guys. I know you guys over in Kiev. Have fun with your little camping trip.
In reality, the United States military dwarfs the Russian military. It's 10-1. I mean, not even remotely the same. If the United States were to go to war against Russia, Russia would be obliterated. But the fact is that the United States can't go to war with Russia because we tried to go to war with Afghanistan and Iraq, and we're so badly bludgeoned that we lost $4 to $6 trillion in the process. So we can't afford to go to war with Russia. But should we go to war with Russia? Yeah, we'd prevail, but we'd bankrupt ourselves in the process. So us threatening Russia does no good, because if we deploy, we bankrupt the nation, we destroy the nation, we turn ourselves into another Kiev. So we can't deploy under that basis. But Europe combined, all of the military might of Europe combined, is no match for the Russians.
Right, so, right. If you limit it to conventional conflict, okay, which culture and which people is going to survive the infrastructural damage more readily, the Russians or the Americans? We live in a glass house or house of cards, right. Infrastructurally.
Correct. Yeah, infrastructurally, what we have done is we're not only $17 trillion in debt, and we not only have $50 trillion of unfunded mandates for Social Security and pensions and Medicare, but our infrastructure is destroyed. We not only can't we build anything in America anymore, we can't maintain what we have, and we're bleeding ourselves dry with our military that is actually counterproductive to America's interest. So the very thing that ended up killing the Soviet Union is now destroying America. You know, when Reagan said we can outspend them, and by outspending them, we'll bring them down. Yeah, he did. But what he didn't calculate is that he didn't just bring down the Soviet Union. He lit the fuse that's going to bring down the United States right along with it. We'll be back with Shattering Myths and this conversation with Glenn about the geopolitical conditions, the economic issues that dominate the Ukraine and the world at large. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation about the economic upheaval in the world, and keep in mind, this is all economic upheaval. What transpired in Ukraine is because did not transpire because a pro-Russian dictator, actually an elected official, wanted to keep the Ukraine in the Russian sphere of influence and didn't want them to consider Western Europe because the same leader had signed three previous agreements with the International Monetary Fund on behalf of Europe and had welched on all three agreements. And this time the terms were so severe that the European Union said, if you want to integrate with us, if you want to do business with us, this time, if you take our money, here are the terms, and the terms were unacceptable. And so that is what occurred, and he got better terms from Russia. And the people foolishly, as parasites, bit off the very tree from which they were being fed.
A handful of people in Kiev, a small group in Kiev.
Correct.
Not the whole country.
That's correct. Yeah, in fact, at the most, you know, they had between 25 and 50,000 people as protesters in Independence Square. That's a country that's 45 million people. They were always a very tiny cross-section of the nation. You know, it's not a popular uprising against the government. That's not to say this government was worthy. It wasn't. It's not to say that Putin's a nice guy. He's not.
Or Yanukovych. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all rotten. And, you know, you look at what happens in Venezuela right now. Venezuela carnage is very swiftly catching up with this. And in Thailand, it's actually worse if you recognize that while there have been 20 killed, civilians killed, which is very similar to the number of civilians killed in Kiev, there are more than 700 that have been wounded. And those protests began the same time in November. And purely economic issues. They want their subsidies. And the government is saying we can't afford the subsidies. Now, the worst part of what's happening in Ukraine, from my perspective, isn't just the forecast of what the players are going to do and how that's going to lead the world to war. My biggest issue is that here's a country whose total debt is only 35% of gross domestic product, and they're bankrupt. It's a country whose debt is only 30 to 35% of gross domestic product, and they're bankrupt. They can't get funding. And so what's the future of a country like the United States, which whose debt is 110% of gross domestic product?
Right. And if Bretton Woods falls through with the dollar being the reserve currency, then it'll accelerate.
Of course. I mean, if it hadn't been for quantitative easing and the Fed's plan on quantitative easing to buy treasury bonds with imaginary money, we would already be in the position that Kiev is in, because no one would be willing to loan the United States money without egregious interest rates and in terms that Americans would not tolerate. And so we would, the United States would be in exactly the same position if it wasn't for kicking the ball down the field a bit and making the problem ultimately worse through quantitative easing.
Well, my theory on that is at the appropriate moment when they've heightened these tensions sufficiently globally, that the monetary system itself is the phoenix that they will burn down and then resurrect in electronic form for the market system.
But, yes, correct. Correct. And by the way, let me just thought on that is the reality is that right now the G20 just announced that it's going to infuse another $2 trillion into the Western economies, which is going to increase the debt of the Western economies. And so it's going to be every country in the West is going to be bankrupt. Every one of them.
Right.
And so what they're going to do is say, we're all bankrupt. We all owe so much that we could never pay this debt. The debt is what's bringing us down. So what we're going to do is we're going to eliminate the debt. And because if you look at America, the average American has $500 in savings and owes almost $300,000 in debt. The average American's the same position that the government's in. And everyone's going to say, hooray. Well, let's go to the new electronic currency because all debt is forgiven. Well, it's because the currency that the debt was in is meaningless.
It'll be a satanic shmita.
Yeah.
You know, the cements the satanic jubilee. But
I tell you what, Glenn, why don't you hold your thought? We are going to go to the news and the top of the hour and commercials, but if you can stay with us, we'll entertain your perspective on what you think this is going to bring to the world. It's important. What we're witnessing is the future of the West. What we're witnessing in the Ukraine is what's going to happen in the United States, so we ought to pay attention. We'll be back after the news.